Good evening. My name is Kane Crawford. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to God and to Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety and for my life, and I am not going to stand here and hold this. I want to thank Lee for the invitation to come up and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. First, I want to tell you I am not who you may have expected to see. I am not a Catholic priest. And I am not gay. But we may have much more in common than we have difference. I don't know. I don't know the gentleman whose place I'm taking. I love Lee. We've been friends for a really long time. And yesterday when he received the call that there was a problem with this gentleman, he said I was the first one he thought of. I'm not sure about that, but I might have been the first one he got a hold of. And so I'm okay with that, too. It's always a privilege to be able to share my story with people who are like me. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is August the 18th, 1990. My home group is the Great Reality Meeting at Stepping Stones in Santa Clarita on Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. Every Sunday morning we read pages 54 and 55 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we talk about where and how to find God. And my sponsor is Craig Randall. Craig has been my sponsor since 2014. My sponsor, Eric, passed in June of 2014. I have not been without a sponsor for more than 2 weeks since I got here. Not suggesting that that is what you need to do, but it's what's worked for me. If you don't have all three of those things, a sponsor, a home group, and a sobriety date, it's a good place to start. Especially a sobriety date, because if you don't have one, we're not sure you're sober. So it's a good place to pick one and stay with it. That's what I'm a first timer. I've not had to relapse yet, and I hope that I don't ever find that need, but I don't look down on those who do. I believe that the only way you can ever fail at this is if you don't come back. That's it. There is no failure in Alcoholics Anonymous. It repeats it over and over again in the Big Book. You cannot fail. We read it every meeting most meetings in chapter 5 with this attitude. You cannot fail. It repeats it over and over again. There is no failure here unless you don't come back. So if you're struggling with this, please keep coming back, and we will keep reaching out and doing everything we can. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I didn't know that it was an alcoholic home when I grew up in it. I know, looking back, that it was an alcoholic home because now I've lived that same nightmare. My dad was an alcoholic. My uncle was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My grandmother on my mother's side was an alcoholic, and the grandfather on the other side was an alcoholic. Everybody around me was an alcoholic, and it was constant drama. And I don't think that's why I'm an alcoholic. I don't think it has anything to do with it. But what it did is it put me in a position where I swore I was never going to take a drink. I am not going to turn out like my father. My father was married 3 times. He'd wrecked 3 cars, and he'd get sober. He was 39 years old, and I am not turning out like that man. If you don't think God's got a sense of humor, when I got here, I'd been married 3 times. I'd wrecked 3 cars, and I was 39 years old. So if you don't think God's got a sense of humor, stick around a minute. I'm pretty sure God is a cosmic comedian. We're his material. He puts us here, and then he says, Jesus, come here, watch this. No, come here. He's gonna do it again. And Jesus goes, come on, Dad. And he goes, it's not me. And we never don't. We never don't do it again. We always do it again. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, and so this is a very, very comfortable place for me. I mean, it should be, but I was sharing in my meeting this morning, and I find it interesting because if we all came back tomorrow morning and then told them our stories, they would look at us aghast. They'd say, what? Well, why would you do it again if it almost killed you? And I'd say, because it didn't. Why wouldn't I do it again? And they don't understand that here. See, we have a unique bond that we understand that. I can't not do it again. He can always call Jesus over to watch because I'm never going to not do it. So I grow up in this household. I'm not going to take a drink. But early in my life, and I don't know when it happened, I can't put a finger on it. My first drink wasn't until I was 18 years old, but a long time before that, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I couldn't have told you that. I didn't know that's what I was feeling, but that's what I was feeling. All the way through school, I was a straight-A student until fourth grade, and then I went, this is not working. You don't make a lot of friends if all you get is A's. If you're that kid that they parade up to the front of the class when the principal walks in the back, you don't make a lot of friends. And I didn't have a lot of friends. I was isolated. I was smart, but I was lonely. And my problem almost, and even remembering back to that, is I wanted to feel on the inside like you look to me on the outside. And that's a bar I can't reach. I will never reach it. Because as soon as I start to feel a little bit like you, my disease says, well, yeah, but what about him? Oh, come on. I was getting so close, and now there's more to do. So I can't ever reach that. I can never feel on the inside like you look to me. And so I walk around restless, irritable, and discontented, and I don't know that that's what's wrong with me. I wish I'd known. Because I went from being a straight-A student to being the class clown, and I spent more time in the principal's office than I did in the classroom. That's just who I became. Because I wanted the attention, and I wanted people to laugh. I didn't care if they were laughing at me or with me. It doesn't matter. It made me feel good that if they were laughing. And so I started acting out. And the principal would look at me every time I walked into that office, and he'd say the same thing I've heard all my life from everybody around me. He'd say, what is wrong with you? And I want to answer him because he's got that look like he expects an answer. Like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I want to answer. So what happens is I begin lying. I begin telling him what I think he wants to hear so that he could just leave me alone and maybe I can go back to class and act up again and then come back in an hour. And that's the way my life went. I graduated from high school with a 1.2 grade point average, which means that they said, look, if we give you a diploma, will you go away? That's what basically happened. And I went away, and that summer, now in February of 1968, my dad got sober. In February of 1969, I handed him a cake for 1 year, and I had never had a drink of alcohol. But I sat in that meeting, and there was a guy up there talking like I'm talking to you tonight, and I didn't hear a word he had to say because I'd never had a drink. Why would I listen? And so I didn't. Now, I don't know if I had listened, if anything would have changed. Probably not, because I was restless, irritable, and discontented right up until I took that very first drink that summer. The summer of 69, after I graduated from high school, I was with a friend at a lake, and they had a swimming race and a running race, and I figured I'll win the swimming race, and he'll win the running race, and we'll both get a girl, and I saw it on Leave It to Beaver, so I know it works, and if you finish fifth, you don't get a girl, you just say, the guy says, hurry up and get out of the water, we got another race, and now I'm embarrassed one more time, and I don't feel on the inside like you looked at me on the outside, and I'm sitting around the fire that night playing my guitar, drinking a Pepsi, miserable. And I looked over across the campgrounds, and on the other side of the campgrounds, there was guys over there with a much better fire than mine. I thought, that figures. And we walked over into their campgrounds. The guy says, why don't you go get something to drink and join us? And remember I told you I was never going to take a drink of alcohol? But I came to that jumping off point that night, and I knew what I was doing wasn't working. And I saw that what they were doing was, because they were having a much better time than I was. And we walked out of that campgrounds, and I gave some old guy $2, and he went into the liquor store, and he bought us back out 2 bottles of Boone's Farm wine. Now, I hear people all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous say, and I crossed an invisible line. I am not an invisible line drunk. Okay, I'm not going to question them. I believe that there are people who approach and approach and approach, and then they cross that line. That's not what happened to me. The very first time I drank, I obliterated the invisible line, and I took the bottle back up to the campgrounds. I spun the cap off the bottle. I threw the cap in the fire. I won't be needing that anymore. Now, I've never tasted this. I don't know what it tastes like. I don't know what it does. I don't know what's going to happen when I do, but I don't care. If I'm gonna, I'm gonna. And I threw the cap in the fire. And I started drinking the Boone's Farm wine. And halfway through that first bottle, I qualified to be here tonight. Because I had my first alcoholic thought. I thought, wow, if a half a bottle does that, wait till I'm done. And I started drinking with a purpose. I started drinking with a purpose that first bottle of Boone's Farm wine. Now, I finished my Boone's Farm wine. I slammed it in the fire and went like that because there's still a little alcohol there. And the guys all clapped me on the back and laughed. And I thought, this is great. And my friend did the strangest thing I'd ever seen. He took the cap out of his pocket, which is where he'd put it, and started putting it back on his bottle, which was not empty. And I said, let me help you out. Don't do that. And so I took his bottle and I drank his bottle. And then I drank some of my new friends, whatever they were drinking. And the very first time I drank, I blacked out. Now, I didn't know that night that I blacked out. I didn't know what a blackout was until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that first night, I blacked out. And the only reason I know I blacked out is because when I got up the next morning, I started throwing up stuff I never ate. And it's not funny. That's tragic. That's horrifying. I don't even like beef jerky. Where did that come from? And I don't know. And I had my second alcoholic thought. I thought, strawberry wine makes me sick. I'm never drinking that again. But they make peach and apple and blue raspberry. I don't know. They make lots of flavors. And so I could drink until I could. Because the drinking was not the problem. I'm not going to stop that. That worked. I wasn't a daily drunk from the very beginning because I thought in 1969 you had to be 21 to buy liquor. I didn't know you could go into any liquor store in the San Fernando Valley, and they really didn't care. They really didn't. But by the middle of that summer, that same friend with the bottle in the pocket and he didn't want it anymore, he had a job in a liquor store, and from that day forward, I was able to drink all he could steal. He'd take it out and put it in his car, and then he'd bring it to me, and I'd put it in my car, and I'd pay him for it, and he had a pocket full of money, and I had a car full of booze. And I was a daily drunk from that day until August the 18th, 1990. I told you I was a car wrecker. I don't know if we got any blackout drivers around here, any blackout car wreckers. I'm going to tell you, the worst thing about wrecking a car in a blackout is that every time I wrecked a car in a blackout, the cops showed up. And cops are inquisitive. I don't know if you've noticed that, but they love to ask questions. And when you come out of a blackout, you're lacking answers a lot of times. They'd say something. What happened here? I'd say, I don't know, sir. I just got here, too. I have no idea what I'd help you out if I could, sir, but I don't know. They'd say, is this your car? I don't know. My car wasn't wrecked when I left the house. If it is, it's for sale. I'll sell it to you cheap if you want. I don't know. Then they ask trick questions. They say, were you driving? There's only two of us here. I didn't come in the cop car. So maybe, I wasn't doing very well if I was. I went about living life. I got married the first time. That lasted less than 2 years. We had a son. He was not even 2 years old when she left me, so it lasted almost 3 years. Not proud of any of this. But I have to tell you because it's who I become when I'm focused on drinking, on my own self-gratification. She took my son and left because I thought it was more important to hang out with my friends and do what I wanted to do than it was to try to help raise that child. I wasn't there for her, ever. Ever. And she finally said, you know, I can't live like this. I'm moving and I'm going to move to Washington and I don't want to hear from you and I don't want your money. I don't want nothing from you. Get out of my life. I'm done. And I thought, woohoo. Yay. She's finally leaving. And that's horrible. What an ugly place to be. And this is only about 4 years into my drinking. It didn't take me long. I've seen that son once since he was 2 years old. I saw him when he was 18. I made amends to him. That was now, he's 40. So that was 22 years ago when I made my amends to him. He said, I'm really happy for you. Thank you very much. Leave me alone. I don't blame him. I'm not his father. He doesn't know me. He knows nothing about me except maybe pictures that he's seen. And that's very sad, but that's the truth. I got married a second time. She had two boys. They were 5 and 7 when I met her. They were 10 and 12 when she died. She was born with a congenital defect. They were both adopted. She had a heart defect. She was not able to bear children. They adopted two children, her and her first husband. And when I met her, they were 5 and 7. And shortly after I met her, she took a turn for the worse. They had done the last open heart surgery they did on her when she was 21. I met her when she was 28. She died when she was 34. And they couldn't do another open heart surgery because her heart had enlarged too much. There was just nothing they could do. So they made her comfortable, and she basically was on home rest for the next 5 years. And we talked extensively. I promised her that I would do what I could to watch after the boys. And when she died, their dad came to me and said, "The boys have been with you almost as long as they were with me. I think we should let them decide where they want to be." So I put on the dog and pony show, which we're amazing at. When we want something, when we can flat put it on, and I flat put it on. I went into that psychiatrist's office every week for 12 weeks, and I looked good, and I sounded good, and I smelled good, and I acted right for 12 weeks. And at the end of 12 weeks, the psychiatrist says, "It's clear to me that the boys want to and should stay with Kane, and I would love to stand here and tell you that I rewarded their trust and devotion with love." But that's not what happened, because I'm an alcoholic. And I rewarded their trust and devotion with terror, with physical, emotional, and mental abuse for the next... My oldest son went in the Army July 31st, 1990, so 19 days before I got sober. He ran into the Army to get away from me. Like I said, I'm not proud of these things, but it's important for me to tell you, and there's a reason for me telling you, and we'll get there. This program can mend families, and it's done that with me. I never sexually abused them. My sponsor has instructed me to tell you that. He says there are so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous who've been victims of sexual abuse. If you don't tell them that that's the case, then you'll hear their minds slam shut. And it's too important. They need to hear this story, so tell them. So I'm telling you. On August the 18th, 1990, I was married a third time. We are since divorced, but... We just simply grew apart. I got sober in August of 90. She got sober in March of 91. She's a good person. She is a good example of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She just went a totally different route in her recovery than I did. She's an isolator. She's still an isolator. She has a sponsor, and she has a couple of AA friends, and that's it. I go to a men's stag on Saturday morning where there's 120 guys every week, and I know every one of them by name, and I give every one of them a hug every week. That's who I am. And we just grew apart, and so it didn't work. On August 18, 1990, I came to standing in the driver's window of my truck. Now, mind you, all this time I'm going every year, and I'm handing my dad a cake. And every year after that first year, I'm going drunk. And I'm handing him a cake drunk at the Radford Group in North Hollywood. And Alabama's coming over and putting her hand on my arm and saying, "Honey, it'll be all right." And I'm thinking, she does not know what she's talking about. There's nothing wrong with me the whole time. And on August 18, 1990, I come to in the stamp, standing in the driver's window of my truck. This isn't the first car I've wrecked. I'm not surprised by it. I'm a little concerned because you shouldn't be able to stand in your driver's window. If you can stand in your driver's window, there's something wrong with your vehicle. And I thought, I'm not a mechanic, but I know that. And I thought, this is not good. And pretty soon the passenger door opens and this guy looks in. He says, "You all right?" I say, "Yeah, I'm good. Thanks. How are you?" Because I don't know who he is, and I don't know why he's there, and I don't know where he came from, and I don't know what's happened. So I crawled up. Now I'm sitting on the running board, and this man's standing down in the street. And I said, "What happened? Because I don't know. I can't think of anything. I can't think of what to say." I said, "What happened?" He says, "You just hit us head on." And I had flipped that truck up on the driver's door and spun it around backwards. I don't know how it happened. I have no idea. But it was sliding down the street backwards on the driver's door, and I don't even know if he ever saw it coming. All he might have seen is a taillight. I don't know. But I slammed into this van, and in that moment, when he said, "You just hit us head on," it talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I felt that. I knew that day I did the very best I could, and that's where it got me. I knew that I had done everything I could do to make this work one more day, and that's where I ended up. And the next words out of my mouth saved my life. I said, "God help me, I can't do this anymore." Now that's the foxhole prayer. It's no different than any other foxhole prayer I said, except that night it came from a different place. It didn't come from here. It didn't come from me trying to outthink this disease one more day. It came from here because I was done. I was absolutely out of answers. I was absolutely out of plans. I was absolutely out of anything I thought could make my life work one more minute. Cops showed up. Big surprise. They always seem to. They said, "Have you been drinking?" I says, "Yes." They says, "How much have you had?" I says, "I've been drinking all night." They said, "Are you drunk?" And I says, "Yes, I am." They put me in the back of the police car, put me in little handcuffs, put me in the back of the police car, and I sat there for 2 hours while they cleaned up the accident. They took the little wheelie-dealy out of the back of their police car, and they measured the only thing they could find to measure. Apparently, I was never alarmed enough to hit the brakes because there was no skid marks at all. But there was a scratch on the asphalt where the driver's side mirror had busted off and the bracket scratched the asphalt down the bumper or whatever it was. Something scratched the asphalt. And they measured that scratch. And it was over 600 feet long. That's 2 football fields. They estimated I was going in excess of 80 miles an hour when the truck flipped onto the driver's door. Who knows what I was doing before that? I don't. But I was going 80 miles an hour when it flipped onto the driver's door. And then it slid 600 feet, starting at 80 miles an hour and ending it in somebody's van. And I'm this far from 80 mile an hour asphalt. First of all, how was I not decapitated when it slammed up onto the door to begin with? Then, how was the skin not ripped from my face and shoulder as it slid at 80 miles an hour along the asphalt with the window down? It was an August night. I'm drunk. Of course the window's down. And somehow I walked away from all of that without a scratch. Now, I didn't realize that sitting on the running board of that truck and telling that man, "God help me, I can't do this anymore." It took me a while to understand that. And what I tell the new guys that come into our men's stag is I say, I tell you, look at how many times you were right here with death. How many times were you face to face, should have been dead, and yet here you are. I want you to look at that because it's pretty important. I am here by the grace of a loving God that I didn't even know I wanted in my life before I got here. But He saved me for myself repeatedly. I should be dead 7 times that I can document. That I can actually give you proof of I should be dead. And yet here I stand reasonably healthy. Able to drive up here and talk with you tonight. Because there's a loving God that didn't allow me to go over and over and over again. I knew I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to the only meeting in the San Fernando Valley as far as I knew. I thought there was one meeting at Radford and North Hollywood. I mean, how many could they possibly need? All 80 alcoholics go there, and that's where it is. So I went because I know everything when I'm brand new. I don't know about your newcomers up here, but the newcomers down there where I am know everything. And if you're not sure they know everything, tell them something and then listen. Because they'll go, "Oh, I know. I know. I know. I know. No, you don't know. You just got out of jail. You know how to go to jail. I know. So I went to that meeting in North Hollywood, and Alabama came over and she brought me a cup of coffee. She said, put her hand on her arm, she's going to be all right, honey. And you know what I thought that night? I thought, you know what? I believe you. I believe you. And she set that coffee down and I looked and it was half empty. I thought, that's cruel. What are they conserving coffee around here? I can't afford a full cup of coffee. I'm going to put more in the basket tonight. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to help take care of that. It took me a long time to realize that she brought me a half a cup because she didn't want me spilling it on everybody around me. Because if I'd have picked that thing up, it would have been everywhere. I was a mess. Still detoxing for several weeks. So the secretary gets up there and does the announcement and says, and if you don't have a big book or directory, you see me after the meeting and don't leave here without one. Now I listened. I better go up. And I went up and after the meeting, I said, I need a big book and directory. She says, oh, are you new? I said, yes, but you can keep it down. Nobody needs to know that. It's an anonymous program. Quiet down between me and you. So she says, that'll be $4.25, please. So I took a $10 bill out of my pocket. I'm going to help him with that coffee thing. I said, keep the change. She says, that's not how we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. You made me take my change. So I walked out of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a big book directory, $5.75 in change, and a resentment. I'm not coming back here ever again. So I went out to my car and I opened that directory. And I looked in that directory. There's a meeting right down the street from my house, which is good because the state of California took my driver's license. They said, we'll take this. You'll get it back in 4 months. I said, I can't wait 4 months. I drive for a living. They said, we don't care. So there's a meeting right down the street from my house. So on Monday night, this is the first meeting was Sunday, second meeting Monday night. I go to the meeting right down the street. It's in a little church schoolroom. It's about the size of one of those little sections back there. And in the church schoolroom, there's a square of tables in the middle and chairs around the outside. And every person in the room smoking two cigarettes at once. They got them going. And I'm not lying. Anybody who's been here a while knows they used to smoke in these meetings. And they smoked them like they were giving them out at the door. And if you don't smoke them up, you got to give them back when you leave. Because they're making sure they're not going to have any left. And they're smoking them. Only time they don't have two cigarettes is if they need some coffee. And then they take a real sip of coffee. And then they smoke in two cigarettes again. So I walk in at 8 o'clock because my directory said 8 o'clock. Right in the directory says 8 o'clock. So I walked in at 8 o'clock because newcomers do not get there at 7:30 for an 8 o'clock meeting. Why would I get there that early? There's nothing to do. So I walk in at 8 o'clock. Meeting starts at 7:30, and they didn't bother to tell the directory people that I had, and they didn't call me, so I walked in at 8. And I walk in the door, and the guy who's secretary of the meeting stops the guy who's sharing. Right in the middle of his chair, he says, excuse me, just 1 second. And he points at me. He says, you'd like to tell us who you are and the nature of your disease? And I thought, no. I can see I'm late. Just leave me alone. I'll find a seat, and I've got a directory. I won't be back anyway. Don't worry about it. But I said, my name's Kane, I'm an alcoholic, got a big lump in my throat. What was that? What the hell was that? If you had asked me that night, I couldn't have told you what it was. But I'll tell you what it was now, because I see it in every meeting I go to. When I go to my Saturday morning meeting, there's 120 guys in a room about half this size. Every single newcomer that stands up, at least two-thirds of the room turns and looks. See where he's at. Who is he? Because they're zeroing in, man. They're going to wait till the break, dude. Wait till the break. And then there's a line. Or they just surround him. One or the other. But it's they're zeroing in. And what happened was when I said, I'm Cain and I'm an alcoholic, the whole room turned and looked. The whole room turned and looked. And when they looked at me, I knew that they knew. I knew that they knew what this is. And they gave me the gift of hope that night. I didn't know that's what they'd done. I had no idea. And I couldn't have told you that for probably 2 years. But that's what they did. At that particular meeting, everybody shares every Monday night. Which is fine. except I have to be at work at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I have a 7:30 meeting that's supposed to get over at 9, and sometimes it doesn't get over till 10 because everybody shares every week. But I finally went to my sponsor and I says, that some of these people need to learn when to shut up. And he said, let me ask you a question. He says, what if this is the only place it's safe for them? Oh, man. Okay. They can share. But what he did is he taught me about how important it is for me to be responsible to make sure these rooms stay safe for the next person who walks in. We got two new people here tonight. Welcome, both of you. I hope nobody does anything to make you feel less than welcome here, less than safe here, ever. I really do. That's important, or we die. And I'm glad he taught me that. So it comes around my turn to share, and I tell him, I wrecked my truck, I lost my license, I drive for a living, I'm probably going to lose my job, and there, he's going to lose his job. That's funny. That's not funny. That's tragic. What are you talking about? Well, if I lose my job, I'll probably get divorced. You people are crazy. I am not coming back here. I'm glad I have a directory. So we get done and we say the Lord's Prayer at the end. I like the Lord's Prayer because I know the words. It's like karaoke. It's more fun if you know the words. I like that. So we get up and we say the Lord's Prayer and I say amen. And I'm done. Not here, you're not. You go to some of these recovery places where they got time on their hands and they go on for hours. They say, keep coming back. It works if you're working. And if your ass falls off and you don't call your sponsor, don't come crying to me. It's like, stop it. Who are you talking to? God stops listening at amen. That's a joke. He doesn't. I'm kidding. That's my disclaimer. He never stops listening. So watch what you say after amen. So now I'm sure I'm not coming back here, and I have a directory, so I'm good. So now I'm making a beeline towards the door. And the problem with that is that I'm this big, and the aisles are that big. And so I'm going, excuse me, and nobody's done with their cigarettes yet. So nobody's going anywhere. They're still smoking their cigarettes and drinking their coffee, and there's still coffee in the pot, so I guess they're going to stay all night. I'm not sure, but I'm out of here. And this old guy steps in front of me and says, hi, I'm Ed, like I care. So I stuck out my hand. I said, hi, Ed. He says, that's not how we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I've been to two meetings, and I've heard that twice. And I thought, I need a rule book. I don't like not knowing the rules. But he hugged me. And he hugged me, and he held me. And he didn't pat me and jump back and go, I'm just hugging him like a guy. He didn't do that. He hugged me and he held me. And he said, welcome home. My wife hadn't hugged me like that in 3 years, so that was all right. He said, I want you to do me a favor. Okay, what do you get for a hug? I don't know what the tables are. I'm brand new here. What do you get for a hug around here? He says, tonight when you get home, I want you to get down on your knees and thank God that I stayed sober today. You're old. What difference does it make? You're going to die soon anyway. Why am I praying for you? I mean, that's what my head is saying, and I must have looked like that because he said it again like I didn't hear him the first time, and I'm just so flummoxed that I can't even respond. Then he says, and I want you to do me one more favor. And I'm thinking, what is this, two for one Monday? I don't even know what the tables are, and now you're going to get two favors for one hug. He says, tomorrow morning we get up, before you do anything, you get down on your knees, you ask God, can I have one more day? Okay. Because I got a directory, I'm not coming back anyway. He says, then he takes the directory out of his pocket, like I don't already have one, and opens it to Tuesday, which is tomorrow night. He says, and I'll see you here tomorrow night. I says, I'm busy tomorrow night. He said, let me ask you a question. I should have run screaming into the night the first time he said that. Because every time he said, let me ask you a question, I ended up doing something I did not want to do. He said, let me ask you a question. Do you drink every day? I said, yes. He said, then you have to go to a meeting every day. Now, I didn't know it then, but if I had said no, I only drank on Thursdays, and I didn't always get drunk, he would have said, then you're so sick, you need to go to a meeting every day. And I was going to be in a meeting every day, whether I liked it or not. And I thought, okay, so I'll go where he has to, where he wants me to go. And so I went to a trailer park by an airport. I used to speed up to drive by that place drunk, and now I'm going in to stay. And I'm thinking, oh, good, it's come to this. And so I pull in, and I walk in, and we've got a pool table in the middle of the rec room, and the meeting's around the pool table. They got the chairs set up, but they're protecting the pool table. I don't know why. It didn't have any felt, but they got a ping pong table on top of it, which was a joke because the ping pong table didn't have any legs. But you knew it was a ping pong table at some point because it was green and it had a white stripe down the middle. And it was shaped like a bowl. So if you put down your coffee on this side, the guy had to pick up his coffee on that side, or they'd both end up in the middle. And I'm thinking, what in the hell am I doing here? And so I sit down and they start the meeting, and the secretary says, before we start the meeting, we have an order of business. We need to elect an intergroup rep. So I stop paying attention because I don't know what an intergroup rep is, and I'm not running. Don't get ahead of me. So Ed raises his hand. He says, I nominate Kane, which concerns me because I'm Kane and I'm not running. Apparently nobody ever told Ed I'm not running for intergroup rep. And a guy across the table who doesn't even know me says, I second the nomination. I said, you don't even know me. How can you second the nomination? Then the secretary says, I move the nominations be closed. Clearly has not read Robert's Rules of Order. He doesn't have a voice. But he said, all in favor, say aye. And everybody said aye except Kane. And I said, wait a minute, what do I got to do? They said, you got to go to the intergroup meeting. I said, when is it? They said, Tuesday. I said, I can't go there Tuesday. I have to come here. They said, don't worry, it's at 6 o'clock. You can go there and then come here and give us a report. So yesterday, I wasn't going to any meetings on Tuesday. Now next Tuesday, I'm going to two. And I'm thinking, I do not like this a bit. So I showed up at intergroup and they said, we have rules. I thought, finally, rules. I like that. I like to know how it works. Not the one in the book, the rules. So they start reading the rules. The first rule is you must have 1 year to be an intergroup rep. I didn't hear another word. My report is done. I went back. They said, do you have a report? I said, yes, I do. Sorry to report, I cannot be your intergroup rep. Ed says, why is that? I said, you have to have 1 year. Ed says, you tell them we don't care. I said, you call and tell them that. I'm not telling them any such thing. I said, there's a sign up on the wall up there that says, we care. He says, not about that. It turns out there's a whole bunch of stuff they do not care about around here. They said to me at Saturday Night Live, it was a huge meeting, it was twice the size of this, and they put out tables and tables and tables and tables and tables and tables and chairs. And all of the tables had, there was 8 seats and 12 ashtrays on every table. 8 seats and 12 ashtrays. And Ed says, why don't you go ask the secretary if you can help clean up? So I went to the secretary. I said, can I help clean up? He says, why don't you pick up the ashtrays? I says, because I don't smoke. He said, we don't care. Just pick up the ashtrays. So I fixed them. I picked up the ashtrays and I banged them on the trash can and then I threw them in the box as hard as I could. So all of a sudden you hear bam, clang, bam, clang, bam, clang. And Ed walks up and taps me on the shoulder. He says, that's why they're aluminum, dummy. They don't break. Okay. So the next week, I wiped them with a paper towel before I put them in the box. And the week after that, I wiped them with a sponge. Then I dried them with a paper towel and put them in the box. The week after that, I brought an SOS from home and I scrubbed those ashtrays. And when I put them out, you could eat out of those ashtrays. And people started coming to Saturday Night Live for the ashtrays. None of you were there. You don't know. I was there. What really happened is that those things that they made me do made those meetings a part of me and me a part of those meetings. Those commitments that I took that I started volunteering for before I knew it. They said, does anybody want to? And I raised my hand. Yeah, I'll help set up the chairs. I'll help clean up afterwards. I'll help whatever you need done. About 5-6 weeks, no, it wasn't 5 or 6, it was 30 days. I was taking my 30-day chip at that Monday night meeting, and I showed up, and by that time I show up about 7:15. I'm trying to beat Ed there, trying to beat him there so that I get there before him just once. And Ed is always there waiting for me. It took me a long time to realize that he lived about 4 houses from that church. All he had to do is know I was on my way, and he had no problem beating me there. It took him 3 minutes to get there. So it wasn't a fair fight. I didn't know that. He knows these things. He's been around. I don't know. So I'm just baffled how he always manages to beat me there. So I show up for my 30-day chip, and I walk up, and he goes, oh, I got bad news. I got 30 days, man. What are you rain on my parole? Come on, man. That's what I'm, I didn't say that. That's what my head is thinking. He says, Tony drank. Oh, man, Tony was the secretary of that meeting. Tony had like 9 months. Tony was like a god to me. And Tony drank. And I'm like, I'm devastated. I'm like, what can I do? And he says, you pray for him. Just like you pray for me. And I said, I will, Ed. I pray for you. Pray for him. And so I prayed for him. And then he says, how would you like to be secretary of the meeting? I said, I only got 30 days. He says, oh, by the way, congratulations. Like it's an afterthought. Come on, man. But okay, so, but I don't want to be secretary. And I'm still not wary enough to stay out of the room and not let the AA Railroad run me over. So I'm in the room, and the AA Railroad runs me over, and I'm now the secretary of the meeting, and I'm like, oh, God. I said, what do I got to do? They say, you got to get here at 6:30. Meeting starts at 7:30. I got to get there at 6:30 and make the coffee. I don't know if you got any coffee makers. So you've got who does if we do, here's what I'll tell you. That's the toughest job in AA, because there's always somebody that likes to get there just early enough to stand there and wait for the red light to come on and go, what time did you get here? Oh, come on, man. I got here at 6:30. He said, well, maybe you should get here at 6:15. Oh, come on. So, but I fixed them. The first time I made coffee, I got even with everybody in the room, because I don't drink coffee. I do now, but I didn't then. And so I read the directions on the can, and it said, for every 12 cups of coffee, use 1 cup of grounds. So I took a coffee cup, and I scooped out the grounds, and it was like a 96-cup coffee maker, so I used 8 coffee cups full of grounds, which was like a half of a 5-pound can. And, well, I don't know. I don't know what they're talking about yet. So I make this coffee, and these guys come over, and it's blacker than the screen of this phone. I mean, it was, you could hear it coming out. It made sounds as it hit the cups. These guys, you know, real big black coffee guys are drinking it with sugar and tea and whatever, anything they can put in it. It's just, it's awful stuff. And by the break, they're all sitting there like this. They can't even hold it under their cigarettes because they're this. But I realized what I did wrong, and the next week I brought one of those little measuring cups from home, and I did it right, and I made really good coffee. I made such good coffee that after I was the ashtray guy at Saturday Night Live, they made me the coffee guy. And then the people stopped coming for the ashtrays, and they started coming for the coffee. Ed started me through my steps right away. He says, I want you to read steps 1, 2, and 3 in the 12 and 12 every day for 14 consecutive days, and read the first 5 chapters in the big book. I said, okay. So after about 9 days, I called him. I says, okay, Ed, I got it. He goes, you got what? I says, I got it. I read it, and I know what you wanted me to find. And he goes, it seems to me you got 5 more days. That's how Ed was with me. He was just always, he was just honest. And he says, you got 5 more days. So I said, okay. And I finished my 14 days. We sat down on his screen porch in his house, and we did the first 3 steps. And then on Wednesday night, this was on a Sunday, on Wednesday night, we got together at the church where our men's stag is, and that church is still there. It's at the corner of Winnetka and Sherman Way in Canoga Park. It's right behind a Burger King, and it's got a big flagstone courtyard. And in the middle of the flagstone courtyard is a fountain, and that's where I said my 3rd-step prayer. And I'll never forget that. I said my 3rd-step prayer at that fountain. I stood up, and he hugged me. He says, you've just been reborn. And I couldn't have told you that night what he was talking about. But I will tell you tonight that I am not the man who came here on August the 18th, 1990. I am a totally different person. Because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the steps, because the steps worked me. They changed me. We finished three. He says, now I want you to start on step four. He says, use the columns in the big book and write through your fourth step. And then we'll sit down at my house. And in the meantime, I was reading steps four and five every day for 14 consecutive days. That's how we did it. 1, 2, and 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And it was always 14 consecutive days. And if I miss a day, I got to start over at 1. It's not miss a day and you start back over at 10. That's not how it goes. You miss a day, you go back to 1. And I never missed a day. I went all the way through without missing a day because I'm obsessive compulsive with almost everything. So I did my fourth step. We sat down on the screen porch again, and he looked at it. He said, where's your boys? I said, well, what do you mean? I got no beef with them. He goes, and then why did you abuse them the way you did? I said, that's discipline, Ed. And he says, do me a favor. Take this in there, right in there in my kitchen. Sit down at the table there. Spend some time. Write through the columns. Let's see what you find out. So I did what I was told to do. I walked in, and I went down, and I looked at the columns, and I started through with both of my boys, all three of my boys, actually. And I found out how selfish and self-centered I truly was. What an angry, vengeful, ugly human being I became behind my alcoholism, behind the insistence that I was going to drink the way I wanted to drink and to heck with everybody around me. So I wrote through the steps with my boys and I saw my part and I realized how incredibly selfish and self-centered I had become and how damaging it had been to those boys. And of course, by this time, my oldest son is in the Army. He's in basic training in Alabama. When he graduated and he came home in October, I actually made my amends to him at that point. But we're not there yet. So we finished the fifth step. He says, okay, now I want you to sit here for an hour and review what you've done to this point, like it says in the big book. And then we'll look at your grosser character defects because we don't have time for all of them. That's exactly how he said it to me. He said, we're just going to look at your grosser character defects because we don't have time for all of them. And I found out he's right. I still find things today in me that are objectionable to me, to the man that I desire to be. So we finished 6 and 7. We did my list of my grosser character defects. And he says, okay, now we're going to make your list of amends. He said, you're going to make that from your four-step list. And we made a list of the amends. He said, you're going to start where you did the most damage. I said, okay, work? He says, no, you're going to start at home. And I went home and I made amends to my now ex-wife and I made amends to my youngest son, who was still living at home at the time. And you know, I used to joke about it, that the longer I was sober, the more they changed. And that's the illusion. That's what it looks like. It looks like the longer I'm sober, the more they change. The truth is, the longer I'm sober, the more I change. And it changes everything about my interactions with the people around me. So I'm going to my meetings. I got a commitment at every meeting I go to. I'm going to 7 to 10 meetings a week, and I got commitments at all of them. And about 3 weeks after I make my amends to my youngest son, he comes to me and he says, could we start spending some time together? And I said, I don't know. I don't have any time. He's 16 years old at the time, and I don't know what to do. So I called Ed, and I said, what do I do? He said, what night do you want? And I says, I don't know. He said, well, why don't you ask him? Because I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do the simplest things. Interpersonally, I don't know how to do the simplest things. So I went to him and I said, what night do you want? And he said, how about Wednesday? And I went to Ed and I said, how about Wednesday? He said, call the secretary and tell him you need to give up your commitment. Give him a couple of weeks to get somebody to cover it. And then you start spending Wednesdays with your son. And that's what I did. My oldest son came home from basic in October. I made my amends to him. He said, thank you very much. I appreciate that. But I'm going to find my birth family. And I'm done with you guys. And he's kept his word. He finally found his birth family. When he did, His birth mother, he found her. He was in the Army. He was a military policeman. He used the investigative arm of the military police to find his birth mother. He called her on the phone. She said, maybe I gave you up for a reason, and hung up on him. And he snapped. Just like a, I can hear the pop in his head almost as though it were real. Because he went absolutely crazy. He is a violent, he acts out violently. He's manic depressive, and when he's in depressive modes, he's suicidal, and when he's manic, he's homicidal. And it's a horrible combination. He's been in and out of the VA hospital in Reno, Nevada for the last 24 years. And there's nothing they can do. They've medicated and they've done cocktails, and as soon as he's out, he throws the meds away, and then he snaps and he beats somebody up, and he's back in the VA hospital. And I contact him regularly. I send him emails for his birthday and for Christmas and Father's Day and all those things. And I do everything I can to continue to offer my amends to him. And he wants nothing to do with any of us. He doesn't contact his brother, doesn't contact anybody. We have one mutual friend. His brother and he have one mutual friend. And he kind of keeps an eye on him through this mutual friend and finds out what's going on with him. But more, he's spending more and more time in the hospital than out. And it breaks my heart, but I can't dwell on that, because if I do, then I lose what I've built with my other son. I started spending time with him every Wednesday, and we started growing together. And when 18 years ago, he got married, and I was invited to the wedding. And that's enough. You don't get there from where I came from, except by the grace of a loving God. And so we went to the wedding. It's a little Jewish ceremony, and they stomp the glass, and then the bride and groom dance. And then they separate, and they invite the parents to come up and dance also, to dance with each of them. And when they separated and invited the parents up, they invited me up first. And I walked up with tears streaming down my face, because you can't get there from where I came from. You can't get there from where I came from. She says, please don't cry, because my mascara is going to run. I said, then I hope you brought more. And I danced with her, and I went and I sat down, and that's enough. But see, God's not done. I believe that God shows off, and I believe that God shows off in all our lives if we learn how to watch for it, if we learn how to see it, if we learn how to acknowledge that that's what's really happening. I'm pretty sure that as often as God elbows and says, watch this, he says, watch this, and then he does something unbelievable. My son lives up in Las Vegas. He's managed an apartment up there for almost 20 years, and so whenever I'm up there, I go stay with him, and we visit, and we have a great time, and we're very close. And I was invited to come up and speak up there about 8 years ago. He was 34 years old. I went up, and I spoke, and I told the story of the frightful abuse I'd put him through and the healing of our relationship, and he sat right in the front, and he cried the entire time. I went down, and I hugged him when I was done, and I said, are you all right? And he says, yes. If my story helps one person, please tell it. So I continue to tell it as part of my amends to my son. And to all of those children out there who have been abused by our disease, because there are many. And that's enough. We're sitting there. We went back to his apartment that night. We're sitting there on the couch watching SportsCenter. In the middle of the story, he mutes the TV. I says, what are you doing? I was watching that. He says, I have to ask you a question. I says, ask me anything you want. He says, why'd you do it? I thought about it for a second, and I said, I don't want to answer that. I'm going to, but I don't want to, because I'm ashamed to tell you that I did it because I could. I did it because I was bigger and stronger than you. I knew there was nothing you could do to stop me. I did it because I could. And my 34-year-old son started sobbing. And I moved over on the couch, and I took him in my arms, and I held him in my arms while he cried like I should have held him when he was 10. And his mother had just died. When he was 10 and his mother just died, I went to him and I said, you got a game today. You still want to play? It's the best I could do. But now he's 34 years old and I have something to give him, because you've filled me up with love, with tenderness, with compassion, with patience. And so I sat there and I stroked his hair and I let him cry. And when he was cried out, I says, you know, if there's ever anything I can do to make it right, all you have to do is tell me. And he said, Cain, you already have. You can't get there from where I came from except by the grace of a loving God. And that's enough. But see, God's not done yet. I went back up there again 2 Thanksgivings ago. And I invited him again to come with me and sit in that meeting. And I told his story again. And as I told his story, he sobbed. And as I was finishing up my night, as I'm finishing up here tonight, he ran up on the stage as I was finishing and embraced me. And an entire room of people stood and applauded us. Not me and my son, but every person in every room that I've been in for 26 years. All of the gifts you've given me that make me that man with a son who loves him that much. We finished up and they said the vision for you, and then we said the Lord's Prayer. And then there were a line of people to thank me, and I was standing watching the line of people to thank me, and I looked over and there was a line just as long to thank him. And I listened in for a second, and one of them stepped up and said, "I just want to thank you for having your father share that truth with us. Because I have a son." You can't get there from where I came from on August the 18th, 1990, except by the grace of a loving God. The steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, good sponsorship has meant a lot for me. The people in these rooms, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the life that I get to live today. Everything I am, everything I will ever be, I owe to people like you in rooms like this and to the loving God that I have in my life today because of you. Thanks for being here tonight, and thanks for letting me share.